Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my friend, who I've forgotten. No, I'm just kidding. By Mark Matzke.
Hello there.
Year-wise, is this 5 years? Probably right around this time that we've been doing shows together.
Wow, yeah.
With like a year break, year and a half break. So probably, I mean, we can't give ourselves too much credit because I bailed, but it's been a while. We started Saswa in spring of 2014. It would have been after the Bigfoot conference. Mm-hmm. So probably like July or June.
June, July.
So yeah, we've been doing shows together for 5 years. If you haven't listened to it, we did a show prior to this called Sass What, which I bailed on after like 2 years. And then Mark and Andy Matzke took over the show and they did it for about a year. About a year's worth of
episodes. We drove it into the ground.
Yeah. Well, someone has to. So today we are, okay, hold on. I'm not going to immediately jump into that. We have events. Monsteropolis, I feel like we haven't done the show in months, but we just did it 2 weeks ago. Monsteropolis is the official show of Small Town Monsters, a film production company. We have events coming up involving Small Town Monsters, not so much Monsteropolis. We are still hoping to get this like live show thing off the ground at some point. So we want to do a live recording, probably locally here in Wadsworth, of the show, and then find some other spots around the potentially around the country where we can record episodes of the show live. But today, yeah, we have next weekend, next Saturday, I'm speaking at a MUFON conference in Columbus, which is kind of weird. I mean, not weird against, it's just surreal to be speaking at a MUFON conference.
What day do you?
Saturday. Yeah, it's only, I think the event is only Saturday, and I'll have a table with like STM stuff too, but I think I'm going to talk about like I don't know. I was in the shower this morning. I was really deeply considering what I should be talking about, and in my brain was like all over the map, and I was like, I don't know how to narrow down, because like I asked him, I said, do I need to be talking about UFOs? And he's like, no, you talk about whatever you want. So I was thinking about doing something that's like, that begins as sort of like documentary as historical preservation and then moves out into me discussing some of the more interesting cases we've covered and maybe like how those cases affected the people long term. Because this idea has been on my mind recently watching. I've started binging a lot of really bad paranormal TV. Ooh. And it's got, and I was in contact yesterday with a production company that wanted me to be on one of these shows, and their pitch is identical to every other show, and it got me thinking about how we've really gotten away from the people, and I'm not just talking about witnesses, I'm talking about just in general, like the people are what kind of make the whole thing interesting to me, and it's always been that way. And every single show that I've spoken to, every show that I'm watching is three or four people with flashlights and a couple FLIR cameras running through the woods. It's every single show. And Anyway, it got me thinking about that and how we've gotten away from the people side of things. One of the things we're really concentrating on with On the Trail of UFOs is that, like, making sure, and it's stated like multiple times that this series is going to be all about the people that kind of drive the whole thing.
You know what that makes me think of is Sasquatch Odyssey. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite Bigfoot theme programs, and it's all about the people.
Yeah, and I got to interview Peter. He's a cool guy. I got to meet him. So I follow him on Facebook. This is a total rabbit trail down. But I follow him on Facebook, and you know, he's like a legit nature documentarian. He's out. He's never in. I feel like he's never in America. It's always like he's out in Africa or something. Like, it's crazy. His life must be like a Indiana Jones with a video camera.
Well, you talked about that in On the Trail. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, how it takes so long to get footage of just a known animal. I thought that was interesting. And that was all based on his experience, evidently.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. I don't know exactly what I'm talking about yet. Probably Flatwoods and some of my experiences with On the Trail. Because I know he said not to worry about sticking to UFOs, but I'm probably going to stick to UFOs because it would be weird for me to get up and start
just
talking
about
them.
Just take some index cards and randomly draw them out of your coat pocket.
I'll have Tommy write gibberish on, and then that's what I'll talk about.
Where is the conference at?
It's in Columbus, and I'm glad you asked that because I've been terrible about this. Let me really quick. let me really quickly pull up the actual location. While I'm doing that, I'm also going to be in Sault Ste. Marie. Is that right? Is that how you say it? Sault Ste. Marie. On the 22nd through the 24th, we're screening Terror in the Skies and doing a Q&A on Friday night of that event. That is the MI Michigan Paracon. It's a huge event. Like there's a ton of people there. Thankfully, I'm going to be there with Cliff and Bobo. Mm-hmm. So I'm not alone as like the only cryptid person because there aren't many. It's almost entirely ghost hunters and stuff like that. The event is not dated. Oh, okay. It's not. There's the Quality Inn and Suites, 1000 Comfort Plaza Drive, Belleville, Ohio. And it's me. It's a lady named Susan Swiatek. She's from Denver. And I guess her husband, Rob, are also going to be there. So we're speaking. Admission is $30 at the door, but I think lunch is included. There's also a potato bar. It's very exciting. Hey,
it sells itself.
Are you coming now? but yeah, that's next weekend, next Saturday, the 17th. I'm speaking at Ohio MUFON. And then the weekend after that is Michigan Paracon. And then the insanity begins. The first weekend of September. Every year, September is our busiest month of the year, and this year is no exception. Although it's nowhere near as insane as last year when you and I were out in Washington and Oregon, followed by three straight. That was one week, and then there was like four straight weeks after that where we were doing something. But this year, so September 6th at the Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington, we're doing the official like world premiere of Momo, the Missouri Monster. And that will be followed by 2 days of CryptidCon in Lexington, which is one of my favorite events. I've done it now all 3 years that they've been running it. So if you're in any state, but particularly Kentucky or Ohio, you can come over and visit with us at that event. We'll be there Saturday and Sunday with a table, but that Friday night premiere is literally the world premiere. And Nick Groff, who executive produced it, is going to be there. Cliff and Bobo will both be there. So you'd meet some of the cast and crew and stuff, and we'll have the full size posters. And I completely forgot to bring you one. I was going to bring you one today. You know what? Adrian and Tommy are coming over. Remind me as soon as we're done. Okay. I'll text them and tell them to bring it over.
Cool.
So yeah, that's the weekend after. And then we have, the Canton Palace Theater. So if you're an Ohio listener, the Canton Palace Theater showing of Momo is taking place Friday the 13th of September. Tickets $7. We're going to be there. I'm assuming this is going to be the largest gathering of cast and crew for the show, for a showing of this movie. Cause pretty much all of the cast, with very few exceptions, at least all the cast that starred in it are Ohio based. And I know Adam, who's based in Tennessee, is coming up for it. So it's going to be a big gathering of cast and crew for Momo at the Canton Palace Theater.
And Momo will be there.
And Momo himself will be there, and you can get pictures with Momo. And we might try to get the Beatle there so people really? Can get their picture on the Beatle. Man. Yeah. So doors at 7, screen plays, the movie starts, screen drops.
The bass drops at 7:30.
The movie starts at 7:30. And most of the STM crew are going to be there, and then a lot of the actors. So make sure you're there for that. And then the next weekend is the Mothman Festival. As we've done the last 3 years now, we're opening Mothman Festival on Friday night at the State Theater with a screening of Terror in the Skies and Momo. It's completely free and back to back. One word of warning. If you're coming for that, bring some sort of fanning device. There is no air conditioning in the State Theater. And it's to the point where I think people kind of make it like an endurance challenge for themselves to come out and see who can stick through it. But it is a lot of fun. And I've seen the same people at this thing like every year. I would also caution listeners, if you want to come to that event, get there extremely early. Every year now we have packed out to the theater to the point where people are sitting at the back on the floor or standing. So if you're planning on coming to that, try to get there very early. But
lodging is probably filling up.
Heard the Knights Inn was the only remaining hotel with rooms. And if you stay there, you'll understand why it's the last remaining. But the Knights Inn in Point Pleasant still has, and the other thing about that event is we'll be there all weekend. So we'll have a tent. This does not include Mark, who decided he was going to marry some people that weekend.
I will be doing.
I made that
there.
Sound
I
like
will,
you were getting right. married. Like you were getting married to some people. But I meant it as in he's literally.
I am officiating.
Yeah, he's the one. Is that what you call it, officiating?
Yes.
Okay.
So that no one gets confused.
Mark's marrying a whole bunch of people.
Right. It's experimental.
So anyway, I think that does it through September. And then we're on an insane filmmaking venture begins at the beginning of October. I don't even think I've told you about that. But Shannon's going to be here at the beginning of October, and we're going to go on basically an 8-day wild ride around the East Coast doing shooting for On the Trail Of, which I was going to remind me as well once the mics stop to talk to you about that too. And then in November, there is an event in November called West Virginia, I think, or Pennsylvania Conference of the Unexplained or something to that effect.
Yeah. Western Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Apparently, despite the fact they did send me brochures, I did not save them. So I have no further information right now, other than the fact that it's like November. I want to say it's like the 11th, but I could be wrong. Anyway, I'll dole out more information on that next show. We got to get into letters because we're already 13 minutes into the episode. We've been babbling. We got emails. The first one came from Michael Kachi. He said about episode 39, really fun episode, but I couldn't help feel that I had heard of this story. He's talking about the Citrus Grove UFO. Mm-hmm. So I looked it up, and yes, Project UFO dramatized it in 1978. From Wikipedia, boys at a military school become involved with a strange substance from a UFO, and a hunter is attacked by a robot. Joyce Brothers stars as Dr. Paulson, based very loosely on the Cisco Grove UFO encounter, as reported in 1964. Note, the robot is a version of Robbie the Robot suit featuring a shorter head with a giant green eye. And he links us to the episode. So we're going to be watching that
movie night
and reviewing it. I'm going to forward you this email. Okay. So you've got this.
Sweet.
Thank you, Mark. That's amazing. Michael, not Mike. Okay. Charles Parsons sends us another email. Oh, did you have any other comments about that? Just no, very excited. Mark looks positively giddy.
happens a lot.
Charles said, "Hey again, guys, as I make my way through your old episodes, I had a couple of comments. As for Bigfoot movies from the 70s, you didn't mention In the Shadow of Bigfoot from 1977. It's a documentary style and made by a hoaxer named Tom Biscardi. And in reply to a question you got on another episode, the Bigfoot in it features a large male genitalia. It's hard to find now, but I've heard it's available at quite a few libraries around the country. Beyond that, would you consider doing an episode on the Green Children of Woolpit? Which is, again, something I've never heard of, but apparently we're going to have to look it up. Mm-hmm. Green Children of Woolpit. So, In the Shadow of Bigfoot, is that one I've seen? I can't think.
That's the first I've heard of it, okay. Actually. It's completely new.
So. Yeah, I know Biscardi does movies, and I've seen them. You know, speaking of this, like, have you seen the BBC doc where they had Biscardi in it, and he keeps asking his wife for like Jolt Cola or something? Oh my gosh,
no,
it's wonderful. I need you to link.
Have you seen what is that called? Not your typical Bigfoot movie. Have you seen that one?
Yes.
The two guys from Portsmouth, and he's in that?
Yeah. Yeah. And one
That's
of them,
an amazing doc.
One of them died recently, too.
Really?
Yeah. I forget which one. I feel bad saying this now because I forget which one. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's been probably 2 years.
The older of the two, I would imagine.
Assume,
I don't know.
Possibly. So anyway, we are talking today about one of my favorite UFO cases, and it was going to be a part of one of the previous episodes, but it just wasn't. So today we're talking about the Cash Landrum UFO encounter from 1980.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I said. I'm going to edit so you can't. So it just sounds like I said that perfectly. So yeah, the Cash Landrum case. Why don't you do a synopsis and then I want to play this audio recording.
Yeah, in, let's see, December 29th, 1980, near Huffman, Texas, there was a car traveling, I don't know how late at night it was, probably.
Had their kid, they were on their way home from dinner, and they had a six-year-old with them, so I'm assuming somewhere between, like, 6 and 8, although it was, what time of year?
December 29th.
Okay, so it could have been any time between 6 and 8, and it's going to be dark out.
Yep, so it's Betty Cash, Vicki Landrum, and Vicky's 7-year-old grandson, Colby, were on their way home, and as they were traveling, they saw a diamond-shaped
with is how they one of them, which is the one that died first?
I believe that would be Betty Cash.
Okay.
She's the one who...
The younger of the two?
Yeah.
Okay, she described it as a diamond with the bottom cut off, and that's where the sort of like port thruster or whatever the flames were shooting out of.
Yeah. So they see this hovering over the road, and Betty, who is driving, actually gets out of the car and steps towards the object, and they notice that there's some incredible sensations of... heat, evidently, although she didn't feel like she was baking or anything, but the dashboard of the car became almost liquefied, so that there was a print from the hand, from Vicky's hand, left over in the car, things of that nature. Betty got back in the car, and I believe they observed a number of helicopters seeming to try to intercept the object in the sky, and as a result of their encounter, they started to each one of them to varying degrees started to experience physical maladies that seemed to indicate, and doctors have gone on record as saying this, that seemed to indicate exposure to radiation, and they developed sicknesses. Betty in particular was afflicted because she was closest to the craft, and was hospitalized almost every year, if not every year, following the exposure to the whatever was in the sky, and ultimately, died from radiation poisoning or just complications from this exposure. So there's a real, in the intervening time, I believe they filed a lawsuit against the federal government because they were not forthcoming with information.
$20 million.
Yeah. And stonewalled them the whole way through.
Yeah.
And it's just an incredible real life story, because you know, you have the proof in these people who were sickened by whatever it is they saw. So, you know, it's not, none of them ever claimed that this was piloted by extraterrestrials or anything of that nature, but whatever mysterious object they saw seemed to expose them to high levels of radiation that had an increasingly negative impact on their lives.
Yeah, we found, or I found an audio recording from on YouTube of Vicki Landrum's report to New Fork about their sighting. It's very difficult to understand, so I'm going to play a little bit of it. If it's incomprehensible, I'll probably turn it off. But here we go.
Over 2 weeks, I got out and she stayed 2 weeks and I had to put her back. And all of her hair has come out. They can't find out exactly what's wrong with her. They keep saying it could be this. There's a possibility of that. But instead of her getting better, she gets worse. And could it have had anything to do with that thing that we stood and watched? Because we were close enough to it that we felt the fire coming.
How close do you feel you were to that?
I'd be safe to say it wasn't more than maybe a block and a half from it. Lit up the whole element. And I thought the world was coming to the end. I really did. I told my grandson not to be afraid that if he saw something come out of it, that it would be Jesus. That's all the way I could explain to him to keep him from going into his area.
Was this a fairly large object?
Yes, sir.
Would it be larger than your car?
Yes, sir.
And did it land on the ground?
No, sir.
So one thing, it's funny, we started the episode out talking about the people that make these cases interesting and, like, you know, focusing on those people and stuff like that, because this case, like, perfectly defines that. In fact, like, I wanted, at one time, the trilogy following the Appalachian Monsters was going to be the Desert Trilogy. We were going to do Sedona, and we were going to do this. It's not really desert, but there's going to be like the West Coast sure. Monsters or something. Yeah. And one of the reasons is I'm so fascinated by the fallout from this event, probably more so than the event itself. To me, this seems to be there's probably a fairly mundane explanation for mundane, you know, compared to like space aliens. It seems to me like it potentially could have been some sort of experimental aircraft. You know, and that the government came and got it. I want to talk a little bit toward the end about what the skeptics believe happened here, as well, and point to why I have such an issue with skeptics to begin with. We're both fairly skeptical. I don't brand myself as a skeptic. People that brand themselves as a skeptic annoy me almost as much as people that brand themselves as like a Bigfooter. Sorry, listeners. But the interesting thing about this is the effect it had on the family, on Debbie and on Vicki and on Betty and on Colby as well. And so you can hear in the recording, she keeps referencing Jesus. She did the same thing in one of those episodes of one of those old shows that I was watching. She kept referencing Jesus and church. And I guess at one point, I don't know if you read this, but I guess at one point she was actually asked to leave her church because she didn't say this. I read this later. So what I took it to be was she was actually asked to leave church because she had basically had the incident happen to her. Now, one of the reports I read said that her pastor asked her to leave church because the radiation had such an effect on her physically that it was disturbing to look at. I don't buy that as a reason a pastor would ask someone to leave a church. And that's not at all what she said in the interview I watched. So I'm assuming she was asked to leave literally because the event happened to her and she had reported it. They were accused of hoaxing the whole thing. They were pretty much made into a laughing stock by a lot of the townspeople. And then, because of the lawsuit, the idea that started being propagated was that the whole thing was a hoax in order to get money. Like, basically, it was a money-making scheme And actually, I'll just get into the skeptic thing now. So, so the Skeptoid website is what I was reading. There's, they did a whole piece about this, and their idea was that, they basically made up the event in order to, make money. Was it Vicky whose hair was falling out, or was that Betty?
Betty's
hair.
They both had it to some degree, yeah, but Betty's was worse.
Betty's hair fell out in clumps after the fact. The doctors said she had alopecia, which is why that is Skeptoid's response to the hair falling out, is that she, you know, she had alopecia, so that would be causing what, you know, the hair to fall out. They basically said everything else was made up, would have been made up, and there's no way to verify what these women say. They completely ignore any kind of like character. To me, in watching interviews with them, they seem, and we've talked about this before, but they seem very, very believable. And it's not just that, it's the fact that they really do seem like God fearing, like, you know, kind of, not the kind of people who are going to go out and make up an alien abduction story in order to make money to take care of their business. Mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't ring true with what I could observe anyway from watching this and watching the UFO Hunters episode, which I think was 2009. The event is still bothering Colby. He was 6 years old at the time. He lost his family over, you know, whatever happened. Even if he didn't literally lose them because of that event, he feels he did. So to him, they were lost over whatever this event is and have no answers about what they experienced that night. Vicky got out of the car too, is the other thing. The only one that remained in the car was Colby, and he suffered the least amount of fallout physically from this. Although he said he did have marks on his back or something like that, something on his back. And I guess later there was sort of, Vicky tried to back up the initially, this is what Skeptoid was talking about, is that initially the only one who sort of reported physical ramifications from the event was Betty. And then later Vicky and Colby both added their own sort of, you know, like we also lost hair, and Colby had something to do with his back, like scrapes on his back or radiation, some sort of marks on his back or something like that. And that was added after the fact. So the idea is that they made it up to sort of bolster Betty's story.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting about that is, at least in like the Unsolved Mysteries episode has credentialed people on record as corroborating their story. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have ex-military guy who saw the helicopters, and you have the doctor who worked on Betty and Vicky, I think, who's, his very bluntly says, I think they were, you know, they had radiation poisoning. Mm-hmm. Just don't know where it came from, but the symptoms are all line up with that. So
this article ignores all that, right, and goes the route that they had to have been lying. And I think that is such a telling thing. You know, they're, it also almost pokes fun at the idea that they were space aliens came after them. They never, in anything I saw anyway, they never stated that they thought it was aliens. Like they wanted to, I mean, there's a reason they sued the US government. Like, yeah. I don't think they were out there at Roswell trying to find answers at the museum. Yeah. Like it seems.
Vicky has a quote, "I don't believe in little green men." Mm-hmm. I mean, she just flat out says it. Yeah. So
yeah, and the thing I watched, she said, "I love my country," and she talks about how much she loves her country and what a patriot she is, but she wants to know what happened to her. And Colby basically said the same thing, you know, back in 2009, 10 years ago. So they, just to my mind anyway, like, this seems like a really weird way to try to get money. You know, like and they write off her cancer as basically like, well, it's breast cancer, you know, like she's probably going to get that at some point anyway, like stuff like that. Like, it just seemed like a very arrogant, typical skeptical response to one of these stories, where rather than try to come up with, it's almost like if a skeptic can't rationally explain something away, they start attacking the character or the people that came forward with it to begin with.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a classic case of, debunking, sort of masquerading as skepticism. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with skepticism.
Right.
But typically, I mean, the situation you're describing, it's somebody just wants to debunk mm-hmm. the story. And yeah. the easiest, quickest way to do that is to attack the quality of the person, the mm-hmm. ad hominem attack is
yeah.
across the board. That's how you do it.
Can you elaborate on some of the other, because there were yeah. other witnesses?
Yeah, let's see. First, before we do that,
yeah.
I'm just going to go through some of the details yeah, of yeah. the actual sighting.
Yeah, for sure.
Because my summary was pretty bad.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks. okay. Thinking that what they were seeing is going back to them driving down the road, thinking it was an airplane on its way to Houston International, they didn't really pay much attention to it. The light was lost to view, but as they rounded a curve, they found themselves on a straight stretch of two-lane road on Highway FM 1485. This time the light was approaching them. Floating above the road at less than treetop height, in short order, it was belching flames from its bottom. Cash and the Landrums were only about 130 feet from the object. Vicki Landrum, who feared they would be burned alive, screamed for Betty, who was driving, to stop. Vicki, and you referenced this before, this is also as a result of the investigation of Schuessler, and this is reported in Jerome Clark. She consoled Colby by assuring him that if somebody comes out of the craft, it's Jesus and he will not hurt us. So make of that what you will, but I think for you and me, that sort of argues for someone who's not lying about it, but mm-hmm. is interpreting this. You know, at the very least, she's trying to help Colby interpret this in a way that he wouldn't be terrified.
Yeah.
And
she literally says too, in the Unsolved Mysteries thing I watched, she was saying, she told him, if you close your eyes, you might not open them again until heaven or something
well,
like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very dramatic statement.
Yeah. Yep. So, they had a sense that they were trapped because the road was narrow. A rain had left the shoulders of the road soggy, and turning around the car, there's a risk of getting stuck. So Betty Cash stepped outside of the car. Just curiosity took over, I think. As did the elder Landrum. So like you said, Vicki did also get out. Colby's screams brought her back into the car. They continued to stare at the object, and an intensely bright object, dull metallic silver in color, shaped like a huge upright diamond. The size of a water tower is one of the ways that it was described. The top and bottom cut off so that they were flat rather than pointed. Small blue lights ringed the center of the craft. Periodically over the next few minutes, flames shot out of the bottom and flared outward to create the effect of a large cone. Every time the fire dissipated, the UFO floated a few feet downward toward the road, but when the flames blasted out, it rose about the same distance. And they did feel heat. So much so that the women could feel their faces burning. The car was too hot to touch. At one point, Vicki Landrum, leaning out of the front window, steadied herself by putting her hands on the dashboard, only to find that it molded to the shape of her fingers, and the imprints were still there when John Schuessler of MUFON examined the car. So a skeptic or debunker would have to explain how they faked that. Mm-hmm. A few minutes later, when Cash tried to get back in the car, the door handle burned her fingers. She used her leather coat to open the door. The final blast of fire and heat, the UFO ascended slowly into the sky. Just as it cleared the treetops, helicopters flew in from all directions. The helicopters and the UFO were lost to view, but when Cash's eyes got used to the dark again, they resumed their journey, passing along another long curve in the road. They saw the UFO and helicopters again. This time, Cash was able to pull off to the side of the road and count 23 helicopters, all clearly visible because the light from the diamond-shaped object was reflecting off of them. The closest was not far from them, made a great racket. Many of the aircraft were later identified as large double-rotor Boeing CH-47 Chinooks, a model used by the Army and the Marines. The whole incident, or at least this part of it, lasted a total of 20 minutes.
The Skeptoid poked some holes in their story because of that as well. The Chinook, I guess, was not part of the Air Force yet. They both recounted seeing Air Force on the side, written on the side of the helicopters, which I thought was probably a valid concern, mm-hmm. you know, regarding the story. But it could also just be explained away. If they didn't say that all the helicopters were Chinooks. So like if some of the standard like single blade, single rotor helicopters were there, maybe those had Air Force written on them and the ladies just misinterpreted it or misremembered. I mean, it sounds like it was a frantic event too.
Sure. Well, to me, I mean, that what does seem extraordinary is just the sheer number of helicopters.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
well, that's what the UFO Hunters episode from 2009. So they interviewed the Air Force commander who would have been like in charge of the base where those helicopters would have flown out. And he was talking about how crazy sort of the actual dispatching of that many copters would be, like the kind of logistics that would go into dispatching that many helicopters. And he was insistent as well that, you know, like he was not told to cover it up, that he was never instructed to cover it up. It seems like a believable guy, very, very defensive of himself and the Air Force at the time. And he talks to Colby about all this. I really can't recommend UFO Hunters enough. I'll probably talk about it a lot on this show, but it's the show, like it's hokey and it's got the like typical guys looking for stuff, you know, like evidence of stuff. But I think the difference is like that very often they find things that are like really interesting, like that, like turning up that Air Force commander and stuff like that. But that episode, I think it's called Alien Fallout or something like that. It's really an interesting episode. I also love their episode on, I think it's called UFO Emergency. It's the one about the Portage Lakes, the Portage County UFO chase, which is one of my favorite stories. So the cover up of this begins with what seems to be an almost immediate repaving of the road where this happened, which is very suspicious. They didn't tear up. So this is something I found from that episode of UFO Hunters. They actually go out to the road where they did bore down into it and pull out the road. And what they can do is they can tell, you know, like where the road would have been when it was repaved and stuff like that. And the interesting thing, the guy that examines it says that they literally paved over a paved road. They didn't scrape the road. They just are frantically repaving the road.
Wow.
So they pave right over a paved road. And it had happened like the next day or the next week. It was a very immediate sort of thing. Like all of a sudden they're repaving this road where all this happened.
Yeah. Cause Schussler on Unsolved Mysteries says that there were trucks, unmarked trucks that came out there and they took parts of the road away in those trucks. Mm-hmm. And then the paving happened after that.
Oh,
like you said, all within one or two days,
very short period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. According to this, they had paved over the road, which I thought was weird.
Mm-hmm.
Schussler was not only a MUFON investigator, but also a NASA contractor. He was a contractor at NASA, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And that's my phone ringing. Apparently it just, apparently that just happens. But yeah, the case was covered on quite a few shows. There, it's fairly easy to go out and find, you know, like a documentary version of this. There's Sightings did it. Unsolved Mysteries did the best version of it. And that episode of UFO Hunters was really good, but all sorts of shows mention it in passing or reference it or do their own sort of retelling of Cash Landrum.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, how quickly like Betty Cash, for example, like that night becomes violently ill.
Yeah.
And she bore the brunt of it, I guess, you know, most likely because she's closest to the object without the car, you know, in between. But, you know, to quote Clark out of his book, it says, by morning, her friends feared Cash was about to die. She lapsed into near unconsciousness. Her friends sought medical help, but the groggy Cash, who had heart problems in the past, could not identify her cardiologist, so they were forced to call unfamiliar physicians. The ones they could reach had no interest in taking on an unfamiliar patient with a history of cardiac disorder, and moreover, with a crazy story about having been injured by a UFO. And keep in mind, this is happening like December 29th, so it's between Christmas and New Year's, and it's just this lull, you know, in the, especially at that time in medical circles. So, friends brought Cash to Vicki Landrum's. Landrum tried to feed Cash. She rejected food and water. continued to grow weaker. Finally, Landrum called the local pharmacist, persuaded him to look through his prescription records for the name of Cash's cardiologist. As soon as she found out who he was, Landrum phoned and was instructed to take Cash to the hospital emergency room right away. Was admitted January 3rd, 1981. She could not walk, had lost large patches of skin and clumps of hair. She was released after 12 days, though her condition was not much better. Later returned to the hospital for another 15 days. Again, I mean, a debunker has to explain away some of these things that are matters of public record.
Yeah, they do.
It's yeah, incredible.
They do. They basically just attack her, them as like, well, this all had to have been made up, or it's
wow, you know,
like a coincidence.
So faking a 12-day hospital stay for the sake of their story.
To bolster the story for the lawsuit. Okay. And this is my, it's an interesting, I feel like in a way the story is a microcosm for a lot of different,
sure,
a lot of different aspects of witness reports.
Right.
And the witness experience, I guess. Sure. There's a lot to talk about here, but we're out of time. Do we want to revisit this maybe at the beginning of another UFO episode?
Sure. Well, here's a potential transition point. Yeah. The Rendlesham Forest incident.
Yeah, I heard about this.
Takes place within a day of this.
Mm-hmm. Similar craft.
Yeah.
Yeah. Weirdly shaped craft that's very similar. Yeah.
So that'd be a nice little touch point, I think, if we were to launch into that and talk a little bit more about maybe the government response. I mean, we touched on that a little bit here, but I think it's very interesting to see the way that their claims were handled.
Yeah. If you like the show, you should leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you listen to Monsteropolis. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow Small Town Monsters on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can follow Monsteropolis on Twitter as well. We don't have an Instagram. Leave us an email. Drop us an email. MonsteropolisMail@gmail.com. And come meet us at any of the events we talked about at the beginning of the show, especially the Canton Palace Theater one, because that's the one that Mark will be at. He's too busy marrying a bunch of people on the 20th. All right. Thanks for listening.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.